What's the future of the UK's welfare state? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Professor Philip Alston of New York University, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, visited the UK in November 2018. Recently, he published his report, claiming the country's social safety net has been deliberately removed and replaced with a harsh and uncaring ethos. Well, not surprisingly, the British government disagrees, but Professor Alston has reignited a debate over what the welfare state is for, how much government should be spending on it, and the impact of austerity. In 2018, the London School of Economics celebrated the 75th anniversary of the Beveridge Report, which formed the blueprint for the UK's modern welfare state. Its Beveridge 2.0 project re-evaluated what the welfare state should be and how it could be delivered. So who better to ask about this than Dame Minouche Shafiq, who, as Beveridge was when he wrote his report, is the director of the LSE. Minouche, welcome to Vox Talks.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Nearly everyone in the developed world today has grown up with some kind of expectation of a social safety net. But this reminds us that a functioning welfare state is still not the norm. It's not easy to deliver. And it is a comparatively recent invention, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, all societies have ways to look after the young and the old and the unemployed and the sick. And in more traditional societies, that's done by the family and the community. But in more advanced economies, the state and the market have a growing role in looking after people. And most societies have a social contract that says, when you're a productive adult, you contribute to the common good. But when you're young and when you're old, you get supported by the community. And the mechanisms for doing that vary enormously across societies.
Why was William Beveridge's report so important? Why was it important to celebrate it?
I think it came at such a critical time, the end of World War II, when society needed a reason to hope for a better future. And what Beveridge's report promised was a world in which people would have much more security after a time when people had faced the most horrible insecurities. Which is why I think the report was a bestseller. I have a copy of the report here on my shelf. And the formal title was Social Insurance and Allied Services, which is not exactly a gripping title. But there literally were queues of thousands of people just round the corner here on Kingsway wanting copies when the government printing office. And it was, in fact, the most widely read government report ever in its time. Because it came at this critical time when citizens wanted to know that the future would be brighter.
But we're in a very different time now. We have changing demographics. We have austerity. We have populism in politics. That's forcing us to reassess what a welfare state should do and what it can do. How big is the risk if we get this wrong?
Well, I think the risk is huge. I think many of the tensions that we see in our societies today, often manifested in things like populism, have their roots in the fact that the current welfare state is not fit for purpose. It's not fit for purpose for many reasons. First, the welfare state in many societies is premised on the assumption that women will look after the young and the old for free. It's premised on different demographics and not equipped to deal with rapidly aging societies. And it's premised on a labor market, which was very different, where workers would have one or two jobs over their lifetimes. They would have a lot of security and insurance around those jobs. And they would retire at a fixed point, which was well determined. And all of those things have changed in the modern economy.
The UN Special Rapporteur clearly thinks that in the UK we've got it wrong. I'll read out one of the things that he wrote. It's that the glue that has held British society together since the Second World War has been deliberately removed and replaced with a harsh and uncaring ethos. Do you agree with that?
I think it's these structural changes that I've identified which have made the current system inadequate. And welfare states tend to be reformed at times of great crisis. So after the Great Depression, you had the New Deal in the US. After World War II, you had the Beveridge Report in this country. Many developing countries, after decolonization, constructed welfare states from scratch. So it's at these times of big structural shifts. And I think at this moment, we are in the midst of these big shifts around aging, the changing role of women, and the role of technology and how that's changing jobs, which mean that a welfare state that might have been adequate before is no longer up to the job.
Now let's look at some of those structural changes in a bit more detail. In the last 75 years, the nature of the labour market, that has completely changed. As you say, many more people are employed now, but they're working in secure jobs because of automation and other pressures. There's also the rise of the gig economy. What can a modern welfare state do to address employment as well as unemployment?
I think there's two areas I'd focus on. First, the fact that the labour market is more flexible is part of the reason why we have such low unemployment today. But there is no reason that you can't have flexibility as well as security. So workers who are on these flexible employment arrangements in the gig economy can have pensions. They can have health insurance, but we need to legislate to give them those rights.
You think it's a good idea to legislate this?
I think it's a good idea to require employers to provide a minimum level of security, even for those workers who are on very flexible terms. I think the other thing that's very different about the labour market is that people change jobs more frequently than in the past, and they will work much longer than in the past because of aging. And so we need to find a mechanism to enable people to reskill frequently over the course of their lives, either through public funding or providing very strong incentives for employers to continue to reskill and retrain their workers. And if you look at the current numbers, they're all going in the wrong direction. Public funding is declining and private investment in worker retraining is declining. And that's a bad omen.
There are some countries that have done this, and it seems odd that more countries haven't picked this up.
Yes, I think there are some countries that have done it well. The Danes stand out. They spend 1.7% of GDP on worker retraining. That is multiple times what any other country spends. But of course, as a consequence, they have a pretty secure labor market, low unemployment, and they top the happiness index because people know that if things go wrong, they will be supported to transition to a better job.
You also mentioned that the labor market was built around men's jobs. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke to Camille Landais, whose office is just around the corner from here, about the impact of policy on women's wages after they become mothers. Do you think that a gender-neutral labour market is possible? If so, can it be a policy priority? Is that feasible?
I think it definitely needs to be a policy priority. We have now reached a stage globally where there are more women graduating from higher education than men. And that includes parts of the world like the Middle East, like sub-Saharan Africa. All that talent needs to be used. And having a gender-neutral labor market which use that talent well is in everyone's interest, not just because it will increase total output, but there's also increasing evidence that using women's labor well increases the productivity of men, because people then will get allocated to the jobs that suit them the best. The kinds of policies we need to get a gender-neutral labor market are well known: affordable and low-cost childcare, more equitable sharing of domestic responsibilities at home, paid maternity leave, policies that support women to re-enter the labor market. All of those things are well known, and we have good examples around the world. I think a gender-neutral labor market solves many problems, both social problems, but also it increases output and productivity and will generate resources that help us deal with other challenges like rising healthcare costs, for example.
Do you think that to achieve a gender-neutral labor market, we need more female policymakers first?
It wouldn't hurt. Yeah, it wouldn't hurt. I'll just leave it at that.
The care crisis that we also hear a lot about at the moment, that shows the very different healthcare challenges that exist now compared to those that inspired the founding of the NHS following the Beveridge Report. In 1942, we could expect to live 67 years. Now it's 81 years in the UK. Yeah. Is it inevitable that healthcare is just going to swallow more and more and more of public spending?
There is an inevitability to rising healthcare costs because as people get richer, they demand better quality healthcare. But it's a question of degree. And I think if we're not careful, we will get massive growth in healthcare costs and not necessarily better health outcomes. I think there are many dimensions to the response. One is people will have to work longer. And I think linking retirement ages to life expectancy is a very sensible policy. The Dutch have done it. Mm-hmm. You know, when Bismarck invented pensions, he set the retirement age at 70. And At that time, it meant that the German state would pay pensions on average for 7 years. Today, the German state has to pay pensions for about 20 years, a much more expensive proposition. So keeping people in work longer is a key part of the financeability of rising healthcare costs. And then, of course, the obvious thing is that we all know that prevention is much cheaper than cure, and most of healthcare spending is spent at the end of life to extend life by very small amounts of time. And these are very difficult ethical issues, but I think we do need to have a serious discussion about investing more in prevention and asking questions about those end-of-life care costs and what society can afford.
It shows us that the welfare state is not just an economic proposition. There are ethical and very subjective dimensions to it as well.
Oh, it goes to the core of society's values.
The Centre for Economic Performance at LSE, that's done a lot of work about another ethical question, and that's how fairly growth should be shared. Economists are talking a lot more now about rising inequality. We've recently seen the launch of the IFS Deaton Review on inequality. Have policymakers over the course of the welfare state been asleep at the wheel about the effects of inequality now? Are we waking up to it too late?
I think it's important to acknowledge that the welfare system has been successful at redistribution in the past. If you look at what happened after the financial crisis, in most countries hit by the crisis, there was actually quite a lot of redistribution that happened that compensated people for sharp falls in their market incomes through the tax and transfer system. And so something like 2 to 4% of GDP was redistributed in many countries in the immediate aftermath of the crisis. But that was because there were some exceptional measures taken at that time. So point one is the welfare state can redistribute. I think the problem we face now is that we have taken our eye off the ball, particularly on the redistributive nature of taxation. And if you look at tax systems in most OECD countries today, they're less progressive than they were before. And there has been an element of tax competition across countries as they've tried to lower corporate tax rates to attract investment and so on. So there is an issue around the progressivity of the tax system. But on the other hand, there's quite a lot of scope for redistribution also on the expenditure side. And I think there are some important opportunities, particularly around helping workers to transition to higher quality jobs where more needs to be done.
You think that making the labour market work better will help to offset some of these problems, because the research that's coming out now about and how the tax base is declining, they are a real challenge to the funding of the welfare state.
They are. I think there is some encouraging work being done internationally on trying to find ways to prevent the erosion of the tax base. So all the debate around digital taxation, destination-based taxation, ways to get some of these platforms to pay tax where things are consumed rather than where they locate their headquarters. And I think that's a very important debate and a really important piece of international cooperation that needs to happen, because citizens need to be reassured that the companies that operate in their countries pay their fair share.
Thinking about the international dimension, we've talked a lot about the UK today, but across the developed world, you're seeing that these debates are breaking out about what the welfare state should be for. Particularly interesting is the US at the moment, where there are aspects of the welfare state being discussed that haven't been in the conversation for a generation. Do you think this is a short-term fashion? It's based around a 2020 election, or do you think that there's really something going to come out of this?
I think we're at an inflection point. I think the structural issues that we discussed at the beginning are putting so much pressure on the welfare state that there is a rethink needed in most countries. And I think that's certainly true in the advanced economies, but it's also true in the developing world, where most countries have started building the foundations of a welfare state. You'll find in most developing countries today, there are school feeding programs. Many countries now have cash transfer schemes where very poor households get a regular cash transfer from the government. And most countries have a core health package that's recommended by the WHO, which includes immunization, maternal and child health, and treatment of communicable diseases. So you can see the ingredients of welfare states being built across many countries. But many developing countries are saying, how can we do this in a way that's affordable for us? And how do we not make some of the same mistakes that some of the advanced economies made? And they have very different demographic challenges as well. So I think this is one of the key issues of our time. And I think it will be key, particularly for maintaining a consensus in support of liberal economies that also need to provide their populations with security.
But if you look around politically at the moment, consensus is very hard to find. Do we think that this, as you say, very important debate might get stuck because people are just arguing at each other?
Well, I think they're arguing at each other about a set of issues that often have very little to do with the fundamental drivers. And so I think for me, it's very important to get underneath what they're arguing about. So, you know, I think the welfare state is at the core of many of the current political debates. If you really dig deep and say, why are people upset about immigration? Why are people against globalization? Actually, it's because they feel insecure in their own lives in terms of their own job prospects and the prospects for their children. And the answer to that is not, let's have protectionism or let's build lots of barriers against immigration. The answer to that is, let's reform the welfare state so that citizens can feel secure in a world that's increasingly competitive, global, and technologically changing.
And can academics move the needle on this debate, or are they always going to be subservient to political reality?
Well, I think Beveridge is a good inspiration. You know, he did move the needle, and he did it by having the right ideas when a political moment of opportunity opened up. And so I think for me, that's something we can do here at the LSE, is be developing those new ideas, and so that when an opportunity arises for good reforms, we'll be ready.
Minoush, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The LSE's Beveridge 2.0 coverage is on its website, and there is loads of interesting research there and opinion. And of course, this has been a huge topic on Vox EU for a decade now. I can't point it all out, but two recent editions featuring LSE faculty, seeing as we're here, are Measuring the Welfare Effects of AI and Automation. And authors are Jacques Bougain, Chris Passarides, and Eric Hazan. And I'm going to give a plug to our Vox talk, The Cost of Kids, with Camille Landais. Well worth listening to if you haven't heard it already. But of course, that's just the tip of the iceberg. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Subscribe on your podcast platform for a new episode every Friday, or dig into the archive at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.